The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 8, 2011. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. It's good to see you all today on this Mother's Day. So I wish you a happy Mother's Day, all of you who are mothers. I thought maybe I would say a little bit about the mother of Buddhas today. I sometimes do that if I end up giving a talk on Mother's Day. It's been a while. Do any of you know who or what the mother of Buddhas is? The Prajnaparamita. That's not fair. You're the old wise one here. I mean, you've been at this a long time. But yes, the Prajna Paramita. And so what's the Prajna Paramita? Well, Prajna is wisdom. That term jna, Prajna, means to know. And it's related to our word know. In the Indo-European languages, all of those people who were there around what was called Yuksur Lake, that eventually was flooded, became the Black Sea, and they all dispersed. In the Indo-European languages at that time, it was around 5,550 BCE when this occurred. And these people were dispersed, and they carried a very similar language with them, but of course it changed over time. And so we find that term jna, J-N-A. In Russia it's Z-N-A, jna. In the Greek it's gno, gnosis, G-N-O. And we have K-N-O. So you have this hard consonant sound with an N and a vowel. They're all related. Of course, in our case, the K ends up becoming silent. So we just have that term no. But these are all related. So that term jna is related to our word no. Prajna, pra, this, putting that in front of the word, it means a thorough knowledge, thoroughgoing knowledge. And prajna paramita, well, as Kanze translated that, as the perfection of wisdom. So this is to take wisdom and to carry it all the way through to its perfection, to complete this thoroughgoingness. So that's that term, Prajna Paramita, the mother of the Buddhas. Prajna Paramita, Buddhas are born of this thoroughgoing wisdom. You know, that's what's behind this. So with this thoroughgoing wisdom, we have the awakened. Well, this term prajna, just prajna by itself, wisdom, this is the term that was given to the Buddha's teaching. And so that would be basically the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths, noble in this sense that one who is of noble bearing would realize and understand this truth. And that first noble truth is the realization that humankind experiences dukkha. And what is that? Well, we translate that as suffering, but dukkha is just this unsatisfactory situation. Now, here we are as human beings, and we seem to know a lot. We have the capacity to understand our situation, it would seem, pretty well. But not well enough so that we don't suffer. We suffer from what it is that we know. Primarily we suffer because we know that we will die. But we also know the difficulty we find in being apart from that which we love. Or those that we love will die, and they do die. We're also together in situations and with people that we don't like. You know, so we have this kind of knowledge and understanding. And as a result of this, we find this situation here very, very unsettling, very difficult. But particularly that one about the fact that we seem to know enough to know that we will die, that we're mortal. And now what? Our knowledge seems to end there, or does it? What happens after we die? And we're bothered by that. Of course, being very imaginative, having these wonderful minds that we have, these human minds, we can imagine all kinds of answers to that question, what happens after we die. And we tell ourselves stories, we have all kinds of explanations, we fight over our explanations because we don't all agree. Sometimes people think maybe we'll go to heaven or hell, or maybe we'll be reborn, or maybe that's just it. It's all over. And then we fight because none of us know. At least not in a conventional way. You can't know that. In our conventional way of conceptualizing and grasping and trying to figure out how this all relates to me, we're just left to our imaginations. We can't know this in a conventional way. All we can do is just kind of come up with explanations and descriptions. And that is very disturbing, to know that. And that is dukkha. That's one manifestation of dukkha. Dukkha manifests in all sorts of ways in human life, but that's really getting down now to the crux of it, the problem here that we have as human beings. Well, jhana, the prajna that the Buddha awoke to, that he understood and that he taught, this is about this truth of the Four Noble Truths, dukkha. In human life, we experience dukkha, this kind of suffering, this kind of pain, this kind of very unsettling situation here. But there's another noble truth. Yeah, I might not leave one with noble bearing if you know that much, but we also know that there's a second noble truth, and that is that this condition, this situation of dukkha arises, that it's not innate. And that we can know this, we can come to realize this too, by a very careful examination of what is taking place here. And with that comes the realization that anything that arises, it also ceases. That's the third noble truth. And finally, what the Buddha taught was this way. The fourth noble truth, there is this way. There's something we can do about this. This situation, there's a way of understanding our situation. That we can bring this sorrowful situation to an end. It's a very peculiar end. I won't get into that now. It's not like an end that's actually an end, because we're still in the situation. But if we stop having a problem with that and we understand it, the deep agony of that situation is gone. It is dissolved without having to rely on any kind of graspable thing, a belief, an idea, an opinion, a theory, an argument. So this is called wisdom. We're still not to the mother of the Buddhas yet. But within this wisdom, particularly we find it there within the fourth noble truth, that the Buddha, when realizing this sorrowful situation that human beings find themselves in, there's something we can do about this, and out of compassion, he began to teach. Of course, what he had to teach, what he had to say about this is quite profound. It's not easy for us to understand because it tends to run so counter to our usual way of thinking and understanding and grasping. But out of compassion, the Buddha looked for a way to teach this, to point this out. Not just this sorrowful situation that we find ourselves in, but that there's something we can do about this. So out of compassion, he began to teach in this way. But this kind of compassion now differs from This is compassion associated with wisdom. And this is different than what we ordinarily might think of as compassion. Because with compassion, what is that? What sort of maybe sympathy for someone else who's suffering? And out of compassion, we will do something then to alleviate their suffering. And of course, we're feeling, we're empathizing with that person. We can understand their feelings. We can relate to that. We've known similar feelings ourselves. And if I were feeling that way, I would feel very sad, very bad. I want to help that person. And I want to alleviate their suffering. So out of compassion, then, we want to take action that will alleviate their suffering. But the understanding of the awakened is such that, well, without wisdom, the kind of actions we might take, it's not that it's bad or wrong that you should act out of sympathy or empathy for someone else. Oh, this is all very good. Be kind and helpful and generous in ways that where you can reach out to others. There's certainly nothing wrong with this. But it's just that without wisdom, without a deeper understanding of what our situation is here, this compassion doesn't end up accomplishing that which we, in arousing a sense of compassion for another, want to ease their suffering. In the end, it doesn't bring this to any kind of completion, because the human situation remains very difficult and pain continues to befall us in various ways. But it isn't bad. I mean, for example, a kind of rule that we all know that comes out of just this ordinary seeing, but without wisdom, would be something like the Golden Rule, which is often touted as like the finest moral law that's ever been created. But of course, philosophers know that, well, the Golden Rule has problems. And what is that? Of course, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Pretty good rule to go by. But it could be that what it is that you would have done unto you isn't precisely what they need or want. It might be just something you happen to like. Like one example is used, like if you're a person who likes to get into fist fights or something like this, so then out of compassion, you start acting toward another person in a way that you would like to be treated, and next thing you're into a fight. And there's all sorts of different ways that can be, we can look at this. So what it means is that in the end, this finest moral law that we've come up with is actually flawed. There are instances in which it won't work. It hasn't been perfected. There is something wrong with this. So that's compassion, but without wisdom. And so from the awakened, as they would see this, in the end, then it's not really compassion. So the compassion of a mother toward a child, the compassion, in this case, the Prajnaparamita, the mother of the Buddha, it operates in a totally different way. We haven't gotten there yet, but right here, just with dealing with wisdom, though, already this situation has changed. And for example, in a way that it would affect the Golden Rule would be it throws it into a negative form, which most people just ignore. Philosophers kind of ignore that because the negative expression of the Golden Rule, they say, is really the same as the positive expression. And so why not just express it in a positive form? But actually, if we look at this very carefully and with some wisdom, we will realize it's a negative expression of the Golden Rule. It's not at all like the positive expression. And what would that be? Well, that would just simply be, do not do unto others what you would not have done unto yourself. That's the negative expression. It's not the negation of the Golden Rule. It's just the Golden Rule expressed in a negative form. And what is the difference here? Well, as the awakened would see it, and this is how, when a wisdom then is applied to this kind of understanding, is that with this negative expression of the Golden Rule, it's not prescriptive. It's not dictating. It's not telling you what it is you need to do. It is just getting us to pause, to stop, and to reflect on this, and to realize that that which you would not have done unto you, don't do that to others. But it isn't telling you what it is you should do to others or for others. There's where we get in to problems, because the awakened, one of the things that most characterizes the awakened is they're very sensitive to their notice, this matter of intention. And when we act out of intent in some small isolated way, even if it is with good intentions to help somebody else, we want out of compassion, but it's not actually compassion. It will link itself to harm in some fashion, and it will continue to perpetuate the very human suffering that we wish to alleviate. This doesn't mean that in any given instance that we forget about kindness and that sort of thing. No, of course not. That's just a given. Be kind and gentle and considerate and thoughtful of others. But if we try to construct a moral code or set of behavior or whatever out of that kind of understanding, it's just too limited. And it will not work, because there's no wisdom in it. So wisdom needs to be applied. Otherwise, we don't actually have full compassion. So what is it that is going on with the perfection of wisdom? Because I haven't talked about this yet. So far, we just talked about wisdom. And this is this deep, profound insight of the Buddha. This realization of the human situation. Here, we find this matter of dukkha. And then there is these things that we can deal with. We realize that dukkha arises, it ceases. Those are the second and third noble truths. And then there's some things that we can do. There's ways that we can act and speak and understand our lives and practice that might bring about the cessation of dukkha as it is seen as just wisdom. But this wisdom yet has yet to be perfected. There are still some problems with it here. And the problems are coming from the residue left from our ordinary thinking of seeing things in terms of, well, even there's a residue even of self here. Seeing things in terms of isolated situations. We're still short of seeing things in terms of wholeness and totality. In which case we can find this perfection of wisdom. When we carry this understanding and bring it into this understanding of the whole, or seeing things in terms of the whole and not in terms of self at all, or in terms of interacting selves, or a situation that befalls us because I'm a human being and therefore I have this human mind, and with this human mind I suffer, we're still looking at it kind of in these terms. So we carry this then even to a more subtle place, and this is called the perfection of wisdom, or this is called prajna paramita, prajna that's been carried beyond, carried across, carried. So it is brought, as Sensung says in the Xinqing Ming, bring it to this point where there's no further. You can't carry it any farther than this. That's the perfection of wisdom. And actually what got me thinking about this, talking about this, was yesterday when I was, I just checked in on our website there, the Dharma Field website. We have those little daily quotes. That was the quote that I saw yesterday. What goes on when we get to this perfection of wisdom is that, you know, with just wisdom, you know, the Four Noble Truths, etc., they're subtle, they're difficult. We have to slow down for that, but we can still, it's an entry point. We can understand, if we just give it some time, we can understand what is going on there. But with the perfection of wisdom, you can't even grasp it. And we end up with statements like this one that appeared on our website yesterday. And I thought, you know, I really should say something about this. Because you can't just read this and understand it unless you kind of work with it a little bit and point out what's going on there. You probably won't even see the compassion in this. But it is not just the perfection of wisdom, but it is the perfection of compassion too. Because what is compassion then, ultimately? If the situation is human suffering, what is compassion but to help others to finally be released from this suffering. To do that and to erase any kind of residue that might be left over. Of course, there's still some just by the very fact that we're using words. But we get to this place where there's no further, we can't take any other steps. But we can point to what it is that we need to see and to realize here about this. And there's nothing more compassionate than that. And that's the great compassion that comes from this mother of Buddhas. These Buddhas who are born of this transcendent wisdom, this perfection of wisdom, this perfection of what it was that the Buddha taught. And so they will end up making statements like this one. Let me read it. This is ostensibly from Bodhidharma. Okay. If you use your mind to try to understand reality, you will understand neither your mind nor reality. If you understand reality without using your mind, you will understand both your mind and reality. Well, as I said, you need help, you can read that. Any kind of sense you might make out of it will seem to be maybe nonsense, which I'm sure there was a time in my life had I read something like that, and I did read things like this, and I thought, well, this is nonsense. I often thought that with these kinds of teachings, but for some reason I stuck around because I could sense there's something going on here. And finally I started to understand these terms here, reality, were all in the small r, but they should be capitalized. If you use your mind, small m mind, just ordinary mind, your mind, just as we normally think of mind, if you use your mind to try to understand reality, actual reality, reality with a capital R, you can understand your reality, or the reality that's created for us by all the advertisements we see on TV and stuff like that. We can that's small r reality. There's all kinds of them. And you can understand that stuff. But reality, actual reality, not the reality that people are making up or telling themselves or using to sell you something or whatever. I mean, it's just endless, that kind of stuff. Or the kind of realities that we grasp and we believe and we trust and we end up fighting over religious wars or political wars or whatever else. Not those kinds of realities, but reality itself, just thus, this here. What's going on? What is this about anyway? Reality. What that reality? If you want to understand reality, okay, that's what he's speaking of here. So if you use your mind, just as we normally think of mind, nothing mysterious here, even though if you look carefully, you might not really know exactly what you mean by your mind. But that's what we're talking about. Let's be casual about it, as we usually are. Well, to my way of thinking, to my mind, you know, that kind of mind. Well, if you want to use that mind, if you use your mind to try to understand reality, and I do believe he means reality with a capital R, so maybe we ought to change that. He said, you will understand neither your mind. You won't even understand your mind. Well, as I said, you know, if you kind of reflect on it a bit, what do you mean by your mind? Of course, we have a very strong sense of that until we look at it. It starts to just could sort of dissipate all over. What do you mean? But we're so convinced that there's that reality of my mind. I mean, my gosh, that's all I am. It's, you know, it just seems so solid and real, but we never really look at it. It's just sort of an assumption, an unexamined assumption. And we go on. But if you're going to use that mind, that thinking mind, that gratitude, something that makes sense to you, putting this together as a bunch of ideas or whatever, and you want to understand reality in this way, he says, you will understand neither your mind nor reality. This is deep compassion, but it's hard for us to get our minds around it. What exactly is he saying here? But he's telling you that this deep problem of human suffering comes from the fact that we do not understand reality. We're very confused about it. And as a result of that confusion, we suffer. We experience dukkha. This is deep compassion. It's not gooey, oozy, sweet, sugary, saccharine compassion, as we might think of compassion. It's not even mentioned. But it's out of a deep sense of compassion for others that they suffer, that one like a Bodhidharma here says something like this. And it's coming straight out of wisdom, perfected wisdom. And as a result of that, of course, we really can't even grasp it. But he's pointing us to this place where we can go, where we can't go beyond, but then from there we can look. We have to just shut up our mouths and not say anything, stop talking to ourselves, stop explaining. Just look at our situation here and look at what's being pointed out. So he says, if you use your mind, okay, that's your thinking mind, your calculating mind, your grasping mind, your sense of self mind. You're going to use that now, and you're going to use this in terms of, well, how can I improve my situation here so I won't suffer as much, and isn't that what the Buddhism is about, and I want to do it. But you're still just locked into self. You're just locked into ordinary mind. And you want to use that mind. Of course, we don't have any familiarity with, well, what other kind of mind is. I mean, that's the only mind. That's all we know. But he's indicating, you know, that's actually not even a real mind. But you know why? It's not a real mind. There's other things we talk about on other occasions. I'm not going to spend any time with it here. But you, what does that refer to? And so you, so your mind, whose mind? What mind? So right from the very start, we don't have any handle on that sort of thing. But if we just continue in this way that we normally do, that's our usual way, our regular mind, our grasping mind, our thinking mind, that kind of mind, even though there's really, the reason you can't get hold of that when you finally start to look is because there actually isn't anything about that. But we don't notice it, but we go on. But if you want to use this, in other words, we just go on our usual way, thinking, calculating, grasping, trying to make sense of the world, to understand reality, what's going on here, to understand what it is that the awakened see, what they've awoken to. You won't understand that reality, and you won't even understand your mind, he says. He says, but if you understand reality, and you do, except most of us, we just ignore that. We ignore the fact that we already understand reality. We already know reality. So that's why he's talking in this way. Though our grasping mind, our thinking mind, our calculating mind, our ego mind can't make any sense of that at all. But he says, if you understand reality without using your mind, okay, because the understanding that is yours immediately and in every moment is this understanding of reality, and that is there. It is there without you using your mind. It's because you do use your mind, your ordinary grasping mind, that you miss out on what it is that you already know, which happens to be reality. And with a conscious realization of that, or a direct awareness of that, these problems that we otherwise suffer from are gone. That's what he's saying here. So out of deep compassion, now he's pointing this out. But he says, if you understand reality without using your mind, he said, then you will understand both your mind and reality. Okay, so we have to do this without using your mind. There's a passage, again, I quoted Tsensang before in the Xinqing Ming, once again, where he talks about when the mind ceases. This is a reference to this ordinary mind, once again, this ego mind. But if you understand reality without using your mind, that, in other words, without thinking about it, without grasping, without forming an idea, without calculating, without holding up some image or idea or notion about yourself or reality or this painful situation, where we just hear and we quiet our minds, we settle our minds. This is our practice of meditation. It's just to settle down, to settle down, and settle down. And how do you do that? You don't do that by trying to settle it down, but give yourself a chance and enter into it in a formal way even. That's what we do here. Enter into this practice of meditation and then just sit there and then do what? Well, just notice what your mind is doing. Just notice that and see if you can just notice it without participating in it, without saying anything about it. without being disturbed by the fact that your mind is jumping around all over the place. Eventually, if you're attending to that, paying attention to that, the mind gets kind of tired of it. It doesn't like you sitting there looking at it, so it starts to settle down. At least you give it a chance to. Of course, if you begin to engage it, you just stir it up again. And this is what we tend to do. I mean, we just do that, and we don't really think much of it. It just comes quite naturally to us very easily, and we're thinking. Very difficult for us just to allow that to settle down, to quiet down. And so we don't use that mind, that calculating mind. And if that really settles enough, you'll realize that you already know. This prajna, this perfection, this prajna paramita is already right here. And with that and awakening to that, then any kind of action that comes out of that realization and that understanding is also the perfection of compassion, or deep compassion. How could it not be? But it is not a compassion that is seen from the standpoint of a self directed toward another individual out there. It is a compassion that is coming from the realization of this life, of the world as a whole, which is your life, it is their life, it is our life. Or maybe we should reverse that, that this life of the world shows up as you or me or them. And in seeing in this way and acting in this way, now we can act and see out of wisdom and compassion. That action that comes out of that seeing, that knowing, that understanding is compassion, the perfection of compassion. And it has nothing to do with calculation. You know, calculated action, trying to bring about certain ends, trying to bring about even the alleviation of suffering. You know, the alleviation of suffering isn't brought about by those means, by trying to do something. It comes about by us stopping and recognizing what it is that we're doing, and what it is that we're doing out of ignorance, out of ignoring what is actually taking place here. So, to have that pointed out then to us, as Bodhidharma does, this is deep compassion. And it is pointing to this mother of Buddhas, this mother of the awakened, because it is out of this deep understanding that the awakened appear. Okay, I guess that's all I'm going to say this morning. But maybe you have some questions about I said, yeah. How is teaching stopping and not doing? Well, this is how Dharma teaching differs from ordinary teaching. Dharma, of course, means teaching. But the teaching of Dharma, or the pointing to Dharma, this is not like ordinary teaching. Ordinary teaching is done with intention. There's an agenda you're trying to get across, something you're trying to explain. We're dealing with very solid things there. It's a much more satisfying kind of teaching to sit and listen to, at least when we're caught up in our ordinary mind, because all you have things, at least you have a chance to understand what's being said. It might be some very esoteric kind of material that you're not very familiar with, and now it's a real struggle. Like sometimes people approach Nagarjuna in that way, as if it were that kind of teaching, it would be very difficult. Now, what's he getting at? You know, or if we get into some kind of deep scientific theory or something, boy, that's really difficult to understand. But potentially, it can be grasped conceptually. But Dharma teaching cannot be, and so that's very frustrating for us when our ordinary calculating, the intellect, our regular conceptualizing mind is operating very heavily, and it normally is. But if that can be settled down and quieted enough, there is this other mind. It's not your mind. This would be mind with a capital N. It's always singing. It's always there. But usually we're so busy with our own mind, we don't hear it. We don't notice it. We don't see it. But in Dharma teaching, isn't really handing you stuff for you. Well, it looks like it is because it's talking, so therefore concepts might be used in that. But what's behind it, what the intent is behind that, is not really to end up giving you a lot of things to grasp. But it'll speak in such a way that it'll bring out that quiet singing of this true mind, or the mind of reality, the song of a whole. I don't know what to say. But it is there, and to the extent that we can let that calculating mind go, we might be able to hear this. So it's a different kind of teaching that eventually we can learn to hear. It is a teaching that is just pointing, rather than saying, here, take hold of this. It's just pointing something out. And very often what is being pointed out is just our own confusion and folly. If anything is being pointed out, that is what's being pointed out. But otherwise, what is being spoken of and said is not something that you can grasp. So I don't know if that satisfies you, Mark, or not, but... yeah, but this is a different kind of teaching in that regard. It's not being done in the usual way of, here, I got this, and I want you to study this, get hold of this, and then you can pass the exam. This is a different kind of teaching. This is a teaching about helping us to reflect on what's actually going on here, right here. And it is a kind of not doing. Yeah. Yes, Cynthia.
When you say that we suffer because we realize we're going to die.
We don't really realize we're going to die, because that's not exactly what the situation we face is. But we think that. We appear to be some particular thing that was born and it lives for a time and then it's going to die. We appear to be something mortal. Okay, so we live with that kind of conviction or that kind of understanding or thinking. And that's suffering. So that's the point I was making about that, I think. But go ahead.
Well, that helps a lot. Okay. My question is going to be, maybe some people live their daily lives with that awareness. I'm not one of them. But I do have all kinds of little neuroses and anxieties and fears and worries. And I was wondering if you think those are all kind of proxies for this big fear that we're going to end
yeah, it's all kind of connected in a sense. And yeah, most of us, I don't think we do spend our every waking moment just dreading the thought of death and this sort of thing. But whenever our attention does turn to it, it's kind of a problem, and certain events might occur in our life that really brings it forward, you know. Death of a loved one or whatever, and things like this, you know, forces us to kind of look at that, you know. But very quickly, as quickly as possible, and sometimes it's easier than other times, but we just set all of that aside, you know, and then, yeah, we have all the little things that we're busy with, and we occupy ourselves with that. And so we say, well, no, I don't spend my time thinking about the death and that sort of thing. You know, I'm sure that's right. It, certainly on a conscious level, we're not doing that. But as human beings, we do have this background realization and understanding. It might not be a correct understanding, but we do have this understanding that we're mortal. And now that's a big problem for us. And who's to say how much that impinges on the other stuff that's kind of floating around on top that we occupy ourselves with. So it's hard to say, you know.
The important point maybe is that it all comes out of this persistent belief. Mm-hmm. This belief that we persist.
Yeah. And so when we get to those places where we start to settle down a bit, now we might become a little bit more reflective, and then that thing starts to loom up, and we feel uncomfortable, and we go and distract ourselves again. You know, and here I was just saying a while ago, what we need to do is to settle down and settle, because we can settle way below that kind of disturbance. And if we learn to do that, like through our meditation, and just settle down into this pervasive, quiet mind, and getting beyond where our own, we're not thinking in things in terms of the little self here. Because we've been watching it, we've been looking at it, noticing that. You start to see how silly all of that is, and how petty it all is, our concerns about this and that. Something else, you know, we can settle down to a very, very quiet and still place. And with that, we can wake up to, we've had it all wrong. The way that we normally look at things is just all wrong. If there's nothing here to grasp, then what is your problem? Because our problem comes from our grasping and thinking that that somehow now I've got to do something to protect this thing that I'm grasping, this dearly loved self here. So that's kind of what we're talking about here. But I'm not making promises. I'm not even giving directives. I'm just saying that we can learn to settle on, because what it is that we truly do know, and I guess this is also what I'm trying to say, is that what we think we're descending through here that's so disturbing and that we don't want to look at, and we tend to go bouncing away and distracting ourselves. We go off to the mall or whatever just to get away from things. But that's not actual knowledge, because what it is that we truly do know is way down here. But there's just like this barrier that we will not allow ourselves to get through because we're kind of afraid of it. But if we just settle, and this could take time, I mean like years, but eventually we can find a very, very still mind, a very quiet mind. And at that point, then we might notice what it is that we've known all along. And that is reality, the truth. It's not something foreign to us. Not something that you don't know now. But when we remain caught up inside, of course, it's the complete dissolving of self. You know, there's no self here that we can find. And so all of the attendant worries and concerns associated with that, they're not in effect anymore. And not only that, we can see, like he says, Bodhidharma said, then you can understand even your own mind. You can see why the world ends up getting constructed in the way that it does. And you can understand why these appearances are occurring. But we can understand that without being caught up in the conceptualization itself. We can use the conceptualization in all of this, but we don't have to be caught by it. Most of us are completely caught by that, thinking that it is real. The way that we construct the world in our minds, we think it's real. It's a reality. Of course, we might know that, yeah, it's a reality, and it differs from other people's reality. And we even might even understand that. But what we don't understand is that all of that, yeah, that's just all constructed reality. It's not reality itself. If there is such a thing, it's reality itself. Because it's not an it. But there is reality, and we already know this. This is why it's also said that you're already enlightened, or you're already Buddha. Norm likes to point out how our teacher used to say, you're already Buddha. You just need to realize this. Why don't we realize it? Well, it's because we're just being tossed around up here on the surface where everything is flying around and we're grasping things and trying to, you know. We have to trust that if you just settle, and what I mean by that, stop thinking and recognize your own thinking and informing a self here and all of that. Just stop doing that. Stop talking to yourself. If there's jabbering going on in your mind, that's fine. Don't contribute to it. Just let that jabbering... Because if you start to watch that very quickly, and just allow yourself to settle and to settle and to settle. Well, I say yourself, but just settle. Just let the settling happen. So we are talking about just quieting the mind. Just allow the mind to quiet. I can't tell you anything. Like, you know, sometimes I've said a few things, I guess, but like you'll see this or see that, but it's nothing to say. What it is that we see finally is just how confused we've been, how confused we are when we take all of the fragments of reality as solid, real, and definite. That they're born, they persist for a time, and then they die. When we realize that is all appearance. All of that is activity of mind itself, including what appears to be the formation of your mind or my mind, is just one of all of the stuff that's going on here. This all can be seen directly if we learn to shut up and to settle down. But most of us find that very difficult to do. It's not difficult to do, but to will ourselves to do. To allow it. And this is why, too, I try to help you to realize that what you need to do in your practice is to establish this regularity. I tell you this over and over again. Because if you do that, just do it. After a few years go by and you just keep doing that, that's not a problem for you just to continue doing that. And if you just continue to do that, And then no matter what's happening up here, you feel like, oh, I must do this, or I must go there, or I have to do this, and so I can't sit today. And but at some point, start to notice that kind of mind acting. If you really catch on and you see it, you see through that mind, you know what it's doing. And you start to, and then be honest with yourself, and just bring yourself back, because this is what you want to do. You want to get into a steady practice. And if you just do that, but I can't tell you, I can't force you. I try to find ways to encourage. That's why we have the practice periods, to help you to set up a schedule for yourself so you do it. And I point this out to you, and well, what can I do? I can't lasso you and tie it to a chair or something. I mean, you know, all I can do is just try to point this out and point this out. Be patient and forget about getting somewhere. Forget about enlightenment. Just let all of that go. Recognize, when I say forget, I mean just look at all of that. It's a greedy mind that's thinking that way. That's what it is. But just bring yourself back to this so you can dispassionately look at what's happening here with you. So all I'm doing is trying to point out some of these things for you in different ways. I'm trying to encourage you to take up this practice like that. But in the end, you're completely free. You know, I'm not going to force you into anything or to insist that you do this or that or whatever. I just point these things out. I practice myself. I don't know if that helps you or not. I saw my teacher practice. That's what he was doing. I caught on that right away. Everybody else was sort of coming and going, hit and miss. But he was. So I started doing that. Because I felt somehow he would point out that was important. And I took him to heart. And it was a struggle, because at first I didn't want, I don't want to go sit down. I remember that. But I was also so tired of the kind of suffering that I was experiencing, and I felt that there was really something to this. So I made that effort and didn't do it quite so perfectly at first, but at some point, something changed and no longer a struggle. And then after that, a while, but then things started that I could understand what it was that these teachings were pointing out, finally. That up until then were very, well, they seemed somewhat opaque. Nagarjuna and others said, well, you know, what are they getting at? I don't understand. Of course, I was trying to understand by grasping, by getting ideas. And that wasn't it at all. They were just points. So I learned to stop talking to myself and just notice what was being pointed out without saying anything to myself about it. Just settling into a very settled mind, quiet mind. And early on, too, I had a big rap on the head when suddenly I discovered I had cancer, and I had a very serious kind of cancer. It was expected to be terminal. But fortunately, at that time, right at that time, just before that, I realized I ought to just sit. I'm very grateful to that, because had I gone the other way, I don't know, I might have just gone winging out all over the place, screaming and hollering. So there's a kind of a groundedness that can come, and a stability, a quietness, a settledness with just, you know, learning to practice in this way. And an understanding will come. Well, the understanding is already there. The understanding will be, you know, the stuff that's keeping you distracted from it will kind of dies away enough so you can see that. So anyway, I hope this is helpful for you. I don't know. Right. I just want you to realize your true mind. Okay. Any other question? I probably should end it. It's getting a little long, but I say that to discourage you from asking another question. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.